Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Welcome to the first podcast featuring Tom Skilling and I would say all of his friends, all scientists. We're in the 720 WGN studios. We have experienced crazy weather in the past 24 hours. In fact, in 12 hours in the Chicagoland area, we saw a tornado and snow. Tom, that concerns me.
And also dust, lightning, hail. It's been something, hasn't it, Lisa?
It really has.
Yeah.
And so we're here to talk about what is happening to the National Weather Service. We relied on them last year for 6.2 billion weather observations. And that's every day, Tom. 6.2 billion every day?
Every day. Processed. Communicated by the Weather Service. Our Weather Service in this country is a remarkable organization. It is lean, it's mean, and it is the source of every piece of weather data. When you pull out your phone and you look at a radar picture, a satellite picture, when you hear a tornado or a snowstorm warning, when you hear a tsunami warning, if you're on our coastline or a hurricane warning, this all originates from the National Weather Service, which generates 1.5 million weather forecasts every year. And 50,000 weather warnings. They operate the weather satellite system that we depend on, a Doppler radar network, all of the weather observation stations in this country, buoys on our oceans and our lakes. It is extraordinary what they do. There is no private entity that could jump in and take over the function of the National Weather Service, and yet we have cuts being proposed to this venerable organization that for 155 years has monitored the weather in this country, a function that started, by the way, right here in the Midwest. The first weather forecast officially issued was a marine forecast for Chicago, and it originated after a Milwaukee professor, by the name of Increase Lapham, became concerned, along with others, about the shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. And I know Ed Fenelon, who's one of our guests, will talk about that. Ed, former director of the office, Weather Service Forecast Office here, he was concerned about that. Wrote Congress, said, isn't it the job of the federal government to offer some guidance for our mariners who are perishing in unpredicted storms on the Great Lakes to issue some sort of warning? And it was from that effort and a bill that was signed into law by President Ulysses S. Grant in 1870, that the entire Weather Bureau, National Weather Service function began in this country.
So and now we're concerned because there are cuts. We've already seen disruptions. There are staffing shortages. They've suspended some launches of weather balloons. That's a critical tool in tracking atmospheric conditions. That's why we're here today. You love and trust Tom Skilling and the people that have been assembled here in the studio, not only in person but on the phone, are people that you admire, Tom. So let's start with introductions.
Oh, we have here an incredible group of scientists who I'm also privileged and honored to call my friends. With us today and in from Washington, D.C., he flew in just to talk to us. Dr. Louis Uccellini, who he studied, as I was studying, up at the University of Wisconsin, finished his doctorate up there, went to work for NASA for a number of years, joined the National Weather Service in 1989, and ascended through the ranks to the director, top position of the National Weather Service from 2013 to 2022. He's an amazing scientist who's authored papers on jet stream structure, on gravity waves, severe weather, snowstorms. He grew up in Long Island and used to, as a young man, watch storms develop Long Island, and developed, as so many in our profession have, a passion in childhood that it became a career, a passion toward meteorology. So Louis has come in, and Louis, you know, Lisa, we did Fermilab tornado seminars for the public for 38 years. And I put a call into Louis and I said, Louis, would you possibly consider coming out and speaking? He came across the country for well over a decade of presentations before the audience that we gathered each year out in Batavia at the Fermilab National Accelerator Lab. He is an amazing administrator, and his views if we want an idea of how the Weather Service functions, and somebody who's intimately knowledgeable about how the Weather Service works, how somebody like that is reacting to the talk of cutting the Weather Service, Louis the guy. So we'll be talking to him. We also have with us Ed Fenelon. And Ed and I worked together. Ed was meteorologist in charge of our National Weather Service forecast office here in Chicago for many years. And Ed is now retired, but has an insight into the kind of connection that develops between our local Weather Service offices and the public, the emergency, the first responders, our government officials who must respond to these terrible weather tragedies we have and take measures to prevent disasters on the weather front. Ed knows something about that, and I've had the privilege of working with the forecast office here in Chicago for many, many years. They're a wonderful, talented group of people.
And on the phone, don't forget.
No, and we have a Nobel Prize winning scientist, an extraordinary researcher, Dr. Don Wobbles, professor emeritus from the University of Illinois. Don spent the last 2 years in the White House as a climate advisor, but he's authored hundreds of scientific papers. He's worked with the IPCC folks. These are the United Nations scientists who put out reports on the state of climate and climate change and climate science. Don, interestingly, in his younger years, was among the young scientists who established the connection between chlorofluorocarbon propellants and the destruction of our stratospheric ozone layer, the so-called ozone hole that we talked about. And he shepherded through, along with other scientists, the Montreal Protocol, which bans the use of chlorofluorocarbon propellants that were destroying our ozone layer. And now the ozone layer is in a state of repair because of that. So Don is with us by phone from the University of Illinois down in Champaign.
Welcome, gentlemen, to the conversation. Thank you for making yourself available.
You.
And I think that you know Tom Skilling, who is so beloved here in Chicago, loves all of you. He respects you. He's worked with you. And he has assembled this panel to discuss what is happening. So, Dr. Uccellini, tell us what's happening in D.C. and if you have concerns about the cuts to the National Weather Service and to NOAA.
Well, clearly, you know, what we're reading, what we're seeing on the news, there's an effort to contract the federal government. Which, you know, there are always pros and cons for any step that is taken along those lines. But the way it is going about with respect to the cuts to employees, and I focus, of course, on the Weather Service and NOAA that I worked within since 1989, has been, remarkably cruel and uninformed. I think that's probably the best way of putting it. These folks are within the Weather Service are top-notch people that competed for the jobs against hundreds of other applicants, literally for each position. Hired out of best universities, for meteorology and hydrology from the. Department of Defense, a lot of veterans coming in now into the Weather Service after their service, their military service. Private sector folks joining the Weather Service. These are top-notch people that have embraced the mission of the Weather Service to provide observations, forecasts, warnings, impact-based decision support services now that are directly linked to public safety officials and emergency managers at every government level to be prepared for and properly respond to extreme events. This is a fabric of collaborative work dedicated to the mission, the second part of the mission statement of saving lives and property. And to see the new employees terminated with very short notice and disassociated from a job they probably dreamed about for maybe their whole lives, like I did, right? was really awful to watch, and I think it's awful for the nation.
Because what kind of impact does that have on us, myself as a, you know, the wife of a farmer, people who live rural, who just believe that we're going to get that alert, Tom, that somebody's going to tell us, take cover, it's headed your way. That impacts every single human being, doesn't it?
We just watched a good chunk of Los Angeles burn down in wildfires, and they were predicted more than a week ahead of time. When you've got to muster the kind of response to a disaster of that proportion, you need advance warning. And the fact is, weather forecasts have gotten more accurate. Louis has stressed the need to for the weather community to discuss and work with hand in hand with the folks who go out there and recover from hurricanes. I mean, you know, think about the weather impact. We have the most varied weather of any country on Earth, arguably. We have everything here: snowstorms, tornadoes, hurricanes, cold waves, heat waves, and we're having more of them, and they're costing more money and having more impact. We had 14 more than billion-dollar disasters last year for the 14th year in a row. These are occurring with – who's paying for the cleanup from all this? It's insurance companies. It's, taxpayers. And, to you know, while you can only mitigate property destruction to some extent, we're saving lives and we're getting people out of harm's way with advance warning that comes from these from the Weather Service. Every one of us has heard a tornado warning and responded to it, a thunderstorm warning and responded to it, a snowstorm warning. Heaven knows here in Chicago, we know what it is to have the weather go nuts. The biggest and most deadly natural disaster in this city was a heat wave in 1995. We lost over 700 people, which shows, you know, how weather sensitive we are here.
And how do we compare to the rest of the world when it comes to the National Weather Service and how efficient we are and how well we alert people?
So that's a interesting question. The National Weather Service today has about, you know, there are different numbers floating around, but about 4,200. You know, I think they're authorized actually up to about 4,800
employees. Yes.
That's actually a decrease from where we were in the turn of the century, where the modernization was coming in, and. The Weather Service went from something like 6,000, a high 5,000 employees, 6,000 down, to the low 5,000, high 4,000s. So as the modernization kicked in, there was a contraction, and there's been a contraction, a slow contraction, since then. So let's say 4,200.
Louis,
it's serving.
Let me jump in here just for a second. Think about that, Lisa.
All right.
4,200 people produce weather information 24/7, 365 days a year for 330 million residents of this country.
Right.
Does that sound bloated to you?
No.
Over at Domain, from Guam, the western Pacific, to the Mid-Atlantic, from the coast, the north coast of Alaska, into the Caribbean, for 11 service areas, from space weather all the way to aviation, tsunamis, the marine environment, winter weather, severe weather season, hurricanes, all of these extreme type of events, which the United States probably has more of, more variation and more of, 4,200 for 330 million. So if you divide that up, you get a ratio. And I can tell you it's the lowest ratio in the globe. So that's actually point one. Point two is, besides serving the American public, which I believe is in a very efficient way, we support the most vigorous and the largest private sector involved in the weather water observations, forecasts, and the delivery of warnings. Every step of the forecast process involves a private sector entity or entities, to the point where then when you release all this information, there's a very vibrant and growing private sector that tailors all that information for specific customer needs, something the Weather Service really can't do, not staffed to do. Now, what's really important is that over the past 10 to 15 years, a contentious relationship in that private-public sector, especially from the mid-90s, has evolved into a very collaborative relationship. There's actually a collaboration chat sessions that go on amongst within the entire weather enterprise before extreme events, especially. But everybody's listening because they understand that the users want consistent information to make life-saving decisions. It's really an amazing evolution that's happened to the point where when I was in the WMO working as the permanent representative for the United States, people from other countries would literally come up to me and ask, how do you make that work? That you have a vibrant National Weather Service and you also have a vibrant private sector working together in ways that other countries just can't seem to make happen. So it's really important that people understand what the enterprise is, exactly how it works, before they start cutting, eliminating, terminating people who are the most dedicated people to mission. And I know that as a fact because even our employees were reviewed over the last 10 years and by McKinsey and Company. And what they got back was that the dedication to mission amongst the Weather Service employees were the highest from any organization they've ever reviewed. And I live that. I saw that. I started witnessing it and experiencing it as I made my move from NASA to the National Weather Service, that this is all about the mission. And it's really remarkable when the entire organization feels that way. You can actually move forward in ways that realize the mission, save lives. It really was not only a joy to be involved in that, I was in awe most of the time in how we made it work. So that's what we have. That's what's at risk today.
And that's what we don't want to lose. We don't want to lose standing within the world. We don't want to lose lives in this country due to cuts that seem to be made carelessly. And last week when I had a conversation with Ed Fennellan and Tom was here, you used the word psychological warfare. And I think that the not just the scientific impact, but the emotional impact that it has not just on National Weather Service employees, but on Americans concerned about where we're going to get this information and if one day we're going to be forced to pay for it. Something we've always taken for granted that we were going to be taken care of. This is something, a service that the government has provided. Ed, talk to us about that and the impact that these cuts have had on the National Weather Service.
Yeah, so we'll take it down to the local level. And of course, the 122 field offices across the National Weather Service, along with the national centers like the Hurricane Center and the Storm Prediction Center, working in collaboration, basically form the backbone of the provision of weather forecasts and warnings for the country. And so we're talking 24/7 hazardous weather warnings, and be it tornadoes, blizzards, severe storms, NWS warnings keep people safe. It's the constant monitoring and alerts 24/7. And you start taking away that capability, and, you know, we put lives at risk through that. And look at aviation for folks flying. Louis flew in this morning to be with us and had the benefit and his pilots and the air traffic controllers of a precise forecast of what was going to happen, as do aircraft all across the United States, 24/7, 365. And you start taking away that, and you start looking at flights becoming more dangerous because we don't have up-to-date weather. Floods, wildfires. Tom mentioned the wildfires out in California, and as an example of the National Weather Service constantly innovating the way that the messaging goes out, for the first time ever, the PDS, particularly dangerous situation, something that we've heard used before for severe thunderstorms and tornadoes, was used for fire weather issuance to alert folks and the partners there know that, hey, this is not your ordinary Santa Ana wind day. This is going to be potentially horrific, and unfortunately it was.
Lisa, you know something. How often have we had the Des Plaines River and other rivers go out of their banks? Do you know that one of the functions of the Weather Service, they have river forecast centers that actually model river levels and tell local mayors and first responders when the river is going to crest, how high it will crest, what it's going to flood. Another thing, too, at the local level, Ed was telling me they map out every outdoor activity that's going to take place in our area. And if we have a severe weather outbreak, they know exactly what groups are going to be affected by this and can get word to these groups to say, hey, maybe it's wise to hold off today, or at least be aware of the fact that you've got a major weather situation. I remember one time we had a circulation, Ed, that the office followed here in Chicago from Batavia through Chicago. It ended up putting down a tornado on the Chicago shoreline up by Loyola University. But that circulation was tracked by these incredible Doppler radars that have been put in across the country, like the one we have at Romeoville. These things have a 27-foot diameter dish rotating atop a 100-foot pedestal under a ray dome. You could stand three people inside one of these radar dishes. Can you imagine what's involved in keeping a radar system like that going and up and running? I mean, the technical expertise is one of the many functions performed by the Weather Service to keep the hardware running.
You mentioned the flooding, and flood inundation mapping is another tool that's on cutting edge being put in place by the National Weather Service offices. This is literally able to show partners, emergency managers, the governor. There's a governor of at least one state that's using this and praising it. Where the floodwaters are going to go, how high they're going to get, what buildings are going to be impacted graphically on a map.
Can I just jump in right there?
Please.
One of the things I heard was that 12 of the people out of, whether it's 150 or 200, you know, the exact numbers is hard to gather, but 12 of the people came out of that water center effort. Who were just let go. Some of the top people in the world in this effort, in terms of not only the flood prediction, but mapping it to every street in the nation.
Louis, will we lose some of these people to other countries? Will other countries go, well, we'd like to put you to work?
Well, we certainly are disrupting the effort to continue these major advancements, which were, you know, brought before Congress. I mean, you just don't do something on. You got to get all of this reviewed, and then move forward with congressional support. The fact that in this example, 12 people let go, they might come back with that court order, but right now they're still on administrative leave, so they're not in the office, and they can't get their emails. So they're still sitting on the sideline. At some point, you're going to lose these people, whether they go work in another country or, you know, just go someplace else and work. You know,
change professions.
Right.
Yeah. So the thing is, I'm sorry for jumping in it, but I just wanted to make sure that people understood that it's local forecast offices are getting that's the touch point for all of these decisions. And maybe Ed, you'd want to go more into that, but it's also in the background, some of the things you're pointing to are being disrupted by the experts that have just been arbitrarily, in an uninformed manner, let go.
And I do want to point out, Don is still on the phone.
Yes, yes.
Let's bring him into this conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we're concerned. We're seeing more and more weather extremes and all, and this is where Don comes in, looking at climate, long-term changes. And Don, you know, the Weather Service and NOAA provide monitoring and all, which has got to be absolutely essential for those of you in the field of climate science who are trying to figure out where we're going with this, with the changing weather that's burning down parts of L.A. and putting hurricanes that intensify more quickly because the oceans are warmer than they ever been before into our coastlines and all.
Certainly. I kind of feel I need to represent the other sides of NOAA, and that which are also a very important part of this agency, that NOAA leads the way in the understanding of the oceans, of our fisheries, of climate, many, many other areas. that are also extremely important to the American people. So I'm going to focus in on climate. It's not that big a part of what NOAA does, but also extremely important. Our climate is changing. That's a fact. And it's not related in any which way to politics, even though I get accused of being political all the time. It's not because of anything I talk about. The science is what it is. And what we're finding is that human activities have led to, or leading, continuing to lead to a major change in the Earth's climate. That's affecting all of the people around the world, but we're particularly concerned about what impacts there are in the United States. So you mentioned earlier the billion-dollar disasters, which, by the way, is tracked by NOAA. And, there used to be a few of those every year, and they do account for the changing GDP in these analyses. This last year, there were 27.
27.
So that's more than one every other week. You know, that's $1 billion disaster affecting the American people every other week. And that's just looking at the United States. That's not looking at the rest of the world. That's huge in terms of how it's affecting us. So it is extremely important that we continue the science, trying to understand what is happening to our planet, and altogether, the politics comes in. What do we do about it? We got to figure that out. But the science is very clear and extremely important.
Is that the driving force behind some of these cuts, Doctor, that they want to eliminate the conversation surrounding climate change?
Well, I can't speak for what their intentions are. You know, that might be the case. I think it's a strange political viewpoint that you want to ignore a major scientific finding affecting us just because it maybe doesn't match your economic viewpoint where we should be emphasizing things. It's very bizarre. We should want to understand what's happening to our planet and how we protect it.
Lisa, you know something. There are two myths that seems to me as an outsider, well, I'm involved in the profession looking in here, that are driving this downsizing mode. One, the notion that the agency is bloated, that all federal agencies are full of fat and bloated and have all kinds of people laying around not doing anything, maybe not even showing up for work. That is not going on in the weather profession. And two, that if we privatize, we'll do it more cheaply. This is crazy. They're going to, if indeed, first of all, if you get rid of the Weather Service or you somehow pare down its mission, people think, oh, we'll go to the Weather Channel or we'll go to some other source. Where do they think the Weather Channel's getting the information?
Right.
Or any of us on the TV station.
Yeah, or their phone, the app on their phone.
Yeah.
It doesn't just magically appear.
Oh, we'll have radar on our phone,
Yeah.
Well, where do you think that comes from? It comes from the National Weather Service. And
who's going to build the satellites?
And maintaining them.
Different observations in the oceans. And, throughout our planet, that makes such a huge impact on our understanding of what our weather is.
Well, and my concern is taxpayers paid for that. And
yeah.
If they're just going to sell it, my concern is if it is privatized, somebody's then going to try and charge us for the National Weather Service
information. And I credit Louis. I mean, the involvement of the private sector and the intertwining between the private sector and the National Weather Service, I mean, we work with one another. We have private entities who take Weather Service data and add value to them and provide them to us for our function as TV weather forecasters, for instance. We have a unique mission in presenting the weather on television. We have to visualize it in a certain way. We have companies that help us do that with our computer systems and all. This isn't the mission of the Weather Service to put a television weather show on. They provide the basic data from which we develop our programs. And we all depend on Weather Service warnings. You want one entity warning about hurricanes or tornadoes or snowstorms so that you don't have 14 different takes on how the developing weather situation is going to develop. In critical periods like that, you want one unified message and one source of data. And the Weather Service provides us that, as no other entities do. Here's another thing. If you think we're going to cut cost by privatizing, we're going to pay twice for the data that we're getting now. We already, as taxpayers, pay for the collection of the operation of satellites, radars, our weather observation stations, our buoys, the communication networks that transmit these, the supercomputer facilities that must run these models that we're using. We pay for that as a taxpayer. If you go through a private entity, they're then going to tack on a price to resell the data that we're already paying for as taxpayers to users. I mean, what are we going to do? Are we going to have cities that have to pay for tornado warnings that they're getting now from the federal government, or cities that are going to have to pay for river level, crest levels, so they know how to dispatch people to respond to an emergency like this? There are certain functions that the government is uniquely able to do and perform on the scale that it has to be done. And there are no substitute private agencies that take this over. And they're going to cost us more money in the long run. They think they're going to save us money. They've got another thought coming. I bought some data. You know, when the European model first became available, there was one vendor, private vendor, who would relay that data. So I contacted them and said, I'd like to see these data sets. And they said, well, here, you plug into and pull down what you need, and we'll assess how much computer time you're going to use. And we were given an estimate. And they decided, after we had signed on with them to get these crummy little minute data sets on with data from a source that we couldn't access otherwise, the bill that came to us blew my. I remember I was called into the news director's office and said, "What the heck is this?"
Explain that you're, this, Tom Skilling.
they had charged us, and you know the funny thing is, I had mentioned getting this data on one of my social media networks, and colleagues were calling, and they said, "Did you get this from this and such a firm?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Oh, brother, did you have trouble with them overcharging?" I said, "Did I have trouble?" It was. We went back and forth. I think the corporate attorney had to finally work out how we paid for it. We better get used to that, because that kind of stuff is going to go on if we start fiddling with our National Weather Service. It's extraordinary. They're a lean, mean organization, and we need them. And
Tom and Lisa, I think you've hit on a really key point there about the economic, and this is a cost savings measure that at least that's the argument.
So they claim.
Put out
yeah.
there. Right.
Yeah.
And in actuality, it's quite the opposite. When you start cutting into the capability that we've developed here with the weather enterprise that Louis discussed earlier,
yes.
The economic losses are actually going to mount. And there is a study done. It's published in by the American Meteorological Society, the AMS. This was done in 2021 or 2022. But anyway, they found, and you can read the study online. It's a 135-page document. Enjoy it. It's very interesting. They concluded that weather forecasts add $102.1 billion in value to the national economy. And, you know, compare that to the NWS annual budget being $1.36 billion. So, you know, do the math. That's if a return on investment there is somewhere in the neighborhood of 73 or 74 to 1. So that, to me, seems like a pretty good bang for the buck.
Yeah. Yeah. Return on your investment. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, along that line, I serve on the NOAA Science Advisory Board. Dr. Rick Spenrad, who was the previous director of NOAA, had done an analysis of, you know, what was really needed for NOAA to really meet all its needs, and he came out with the idea that we need 5,000 more people in NOAA to really do the job effectively, not less.
Yeah,
and so that also, you know, says NOAA is really important to the American people. We need to be understanding that.
Well, and I think that, you know, I don't think anybody here is going to argue the fact that modernizing government is a bad idea. I mean, it's a good idea. We've done that
before. It's been ongoing.
It really has. And I think really what we're looking at here is just the way that the cuts are being done. they simply are not creating efficiency. Instead, they're dismantling capability.
Louis, you as former director of the Weather Service, do you know of anybody who understands the basis on which they're making the cuts that have been made? Is there a methodology that's being followed? Because this is not being done in a transparent way.
Well, I think your last comment, it's not been done in a transparent way, and it's hard to even get the numbers of who.
Yeah, how many have been released?
But it's you know, just watching the news like everybody else does has been the source of my information. I don't think they, that's why I said it's an uninformed approach and it's an uninformed decision in terms of what they're doing. With the idea that there was waste, fraud, and abuse, remember that was used the first 2 weeks as a phrase. I can tell you, with what I know about NOAA, and Don is absolutely right, we need NOAA, you know, for the satellites, and we need NOAA for the other aspects of the oceans, the coastal areas. That's all become part of this collaborative, integrated approach within NOAA and within the larger government, within the what I would call the enterprise of the weather, water, climate work that goes on here in the United States. You know, I as part of the WMO, again, I noted how people came to us and asked us.
Louis, let me explain. Yeah. WMO is the World Meteorological Organization.
Right. 140-something countries.
Yes.
Really, you know, grew out of post-World War II. It was one of the reasons we were able to get global observations. One of the first things they did was standardize the global observations kind of thing.
And they also coordinate the exchange of information internationally so that our data goes to other countries and we get theirs in return so that we can see the whole planet's weather. There's no way to forecast the weather just looking at our area. You've got to get the whole world involved.
You need the globe to actually make a local. You need global observations, global modeling to make local forecasts. But the point I want to make is there were some countries that actually privatized everything, right? The whole forecast process. And what by using, you know, using a contractor to do that. So what happened in that country afterwards? There was no other private sector. Right? And from the United States perspective, you couldn't get in to that area. They were, you know, it was sort of like it was a monopoly developed within that country. We saw this since, I'm not going to go into specific country names, but there have been countries in Europe that have done this, and one more recently has been, I'll just mention that one, is Hungary. And I asked about the number of private sector, when I visited Budapest, they were on the verge of transferring to it. And then afterwards, I saw the head of the Weather Service there. Now that it had been privatized. And how many private companies you have in Hungary? You know, that zero. How many private sector firms from outside of Hungary can get into zero? So the point is, it doesn't facilitate the extent of private sector work we have now. It would not facilitate that because I can tell you that the private sector is integrated in every step of the forecast process, from observations to central processing, modeling, forecasting itself and the service to individuals, dissemination, even in the science and technology integration they become. So when I hear this about being, you can replace the weather, no. You really want to foster this relationship aspect. I also would like to build off something that Don said, if it's possible, with respect to the climate. The Weather Service actually provides forecasts out to 9 months in advance. It's the sub-seasonal to seasonal. The agricultural community is a big driver of that. The basic view is that anything beyond a two-week forecast is in the climate domain. But there's this gray zone in weeks 3 and 4, and then this effort to not produce, you know, specific day by day forecasts. That's not what. But drought monitoring, drought prediction, above and below normal precipitation, above and below normal temperatures. What has happened over the past 10, 15 years with respect to droughts, is something has developed and became more obvious in the northern Midwest in the, by the farming community, is something called the flash drought. There was a perception, I would say, pre-global warming recognition, where droughts evolved over a long period of time and would be basically addressed by rainfall over a relatively short period of time. But the evolution of a drought was considered sort of a long-term thing. So some really interesting things started happening about 5-10 years ago, is that seasonal forecasts were made in April and May for what the farming season would be like in the northern Midwest. And, this looks like a good, it's going to be a good year for precipitation and all that. And we went into not only a dry, hot period early on in May, June, but extremely dry and hot, to the point where droughts were developing within a month after those forecasts, to the point where what was just planted was not going to make it. This was in states like South Dakota, Nebraska. Remember it very clearly. And Senator Thune, who was the chair of the Authorization Committee, we called a meeting through his staff to meet on predictions in this subseasonal, the seasonal range. This is a big challenge. First of all, we're seeing things we haven't really observed before, evolve in the climate domain that affected the agricultural communities, but also the water resource management people. This became a big problem. It's still a big problem. It's still a big issue. So, this separation of climate and weather, I mean, it's, meteorology is defined with two words, weather and climate, yeah, right? And then there's hydrology for water, right? But the fact is, there are efforts today operationally to deal with this, and it's serving needs of the agricultural community, the water community, the energy community, all right? I mean, it's writ large. And then you get into the recreational communities and everything else, which the private sector serves,
yeah,
is being impacted by the same type of things that we're observing. So I just want to emphasize, these are growing issues today. I forgot to mention the fire community, because one of the things about fire, and Ed, you're smiling, you jump in here, you gotta understand the fuel and the nature of how wet or dry the fuel is that feeds these fires, as much as what the weather conditions are that, once they form, they burn hotter, they move faster now than they used to. All of this is interconnected. This is this thread I was talking about, this fabric of making these forecasts and addressing the needs of a wide range of the decision makers through these impact-based assistance support services covers all of this, everything I've just talked about. So the job of the meteorologist in the National Weather Service today does not end with an observation, forecast, and warning. They have to connect these effectively to decision makers for the protection of lives and property. That's in the mission statement. And it's actually crucial that we do not pull that apart, because if that aspect breaks apart, we could be back to where we were at the turn of the century, making good forecasts, great forecasts, warnings with extra lead time, and people still died because we weren't connecting properly to these kinds of to decision makers under these kinds of circumstances. That's what I worry about.
Yeah. And at the core of that is, the public safety. It's a team effort, and that's what we've got right now. That's the infrastructure that we've worked to develop, and we've got some of the brightest minds charged with that responsibility right now, and it's working wonderfully, and we want it to keep going.
It's interesting, Lisa. If you look at warnings, bringing this all to life in terms of the warnings we get, it used to be you got a tornado warning for a particular county. Now, if you read the text, it tells you exactly what this storm is going to do. It's going to take down trees, power lines, and affect the community in this specific way. And this helps the people who are charged with responding to these disasters knowing what they're facing, that what the nature of the disaster will be.
That was another one of the initiatives that Louis alluded to. Impact-based warnings was a big push to implement that here. And my concern, you know, if we go in a direction as to what Louis was describing with some different countries and there being zero others involved, you know, you take away that team. It's crippling.
There's collaboration that goes on before the products go out now.
Yeah.
With the private sector firms, not to tell them what to do.
Right.
There's a listening session. The idea here is in this collaborative forecast process, a term, by the way, I heard from Ed first way back when, that you get a consistent message. The decision makers, when I got the job as director of Weather Service, I met with Craig Fugate from FEMA. He said, the most important thing you got to do is get your products and services consistently. I can't get different forecasts from every forecast office, okay? So we worked within the Weather Service, but it turns out that's important for the entire enterprise. Tom, if you were saying something that was different, way off the mark from what they were putting out,
there'd be confusion.
There'd be total confusion, right?
Yeah.
So this became a critical part of the fabric of the whole enterprise, dealing with these incredible extreme events. Fire, you know, like even after the fire now, you got debris flow because the soils are impacted. They were evacuating people with that next rainstorm north of Los Angeles after the fire.
Yes.
2 days before the event, and they had debris flow, right? So it's like all of this is working, right? You don't want to disrupt it.
I'll give you a small example of how attuned to the user community, the people who actually take the data that the Weather Service is producing and use it as part of the function. I was at a weather conference, and Louis had just taken over as director, and he said to me, he remembered when we used to gather at the University of Wisconsin, we had a map room where grad students and I was the undergrad would gather and discuss the storm that was developing. It was kind of interesting. And then I would go on television. I did part-time television work at the time. The problem is the weather computer models we use are run based on weather balloon launches at 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening Central Time. And the computer models take a couple hours to digest all the data and come out. So when I would get on the air at 9 or 10 o'clock here in Chicago or up in Madison, wherever I was working at the time, I wouldn't have access with a big snowstorm looming in the process to the latest data to see if that storm was still on track. And so I'd often get done and I get off the air and products that told me whether or not the new balloon launch had indicated weather conditions were coming together to support the storm I had just told everybody was going to affect them the next day. I'd see a map that might have changed my mind had I gotten it on time. And Louis said to me, he said, have you noticed? I noticed right away after Louis assumed the top position that we started getting the computer models earlier in the evening. And he came over to me with a grin on his face and he said, have you noticed? He said, we're getting the model data out earlier because, he said, I remember that when you used to go on the television in Madison that there'd be a storm brewing and you had not gotten the new information before you got on the air at 9 and 10 o'clock on those critical evening news shows to inform the public whether they were going to wake up to a blizzard the next morning or the storm was going to miss. And you said you instructed the people we've got to kick this data out as the machines, instead of waiting for the computer model to get done, kick out the data as the model's running it and transmit it to users like the television community that interfaces with the public. And that has been amazing. Another thing that used to happen, when we first started getting computer models, which Louis, by the way, says was one of the modeling of the atmosphere, which has improved our forecast accuracy dramatically. Louis considers it one of the top 10 achievements of science in the 20th century, right up there with the space program, computer technology, penicillin, and all the medicines we use. And it is. I mean, the lives that have been saved by accurate forecasting made possible by these models is just amazing. But at any rate, it's just a great example about how This agency has attempted to meet the needs of those of us who interface with the public and pass this information on. And it's just one of myriad examples. Another thing I was talking with Ed about Ed's that tornado, that circulation that started out in the Fox Valley by Batavia, and it went all the way across the Chicago area. And thank God, waited till the shoreline up by Loyola University here on the north side to put down a tornado that then went harmlessly out into the lake. The local office has mapped out every school, every hospital, every gathering of a population, so that when they're watching these storms cross the area, they know precisely what entities are threatened, what schools, what hospitals, what major thoroughfares are being threatened. And this is where you're not just looking at the meteorological data, you understand how the weather pattern you're tracking is going to really impact people down, you know, where they live.
Absolutely. I will tell you, I'm in a car driving in the country, doesn't look like a bad day, yeah. And we're making our way through a rural area of southeastern Wisconsin, and we see fire trucks. We see some first responders, and we pull up and said, "What's happening?" And they're like, "There's a tornado coming this way. We have tracked it. They're tracking it. You need to turn around. You need to head in that direction." That was so unbelievable because, of course, we were listening to music on the radio. We weren't thinking, yeah, it looked like there might be a little bit of storm, but we were driving into the path of a tornado. And Ed, talk about that, how first responders, police departments, fire departments are there to warn their local communities and many times set up camp just to make sure they can prevent people from driving into the path of a catastrophic tornado or hurricane.
Absolutely, yeah. And this will start days before the event. Emergency managers and other planners will start preparing, mobilizing, go where they need to go, position things, maybe change plans if there's a outdoor concert or a sporting event or a fair or a parade involved. All of that goes in. And Tom, you mentioned that supercell that tracked across the Chicagoland area and waited until Loyola before it spawned a tornado. Boy, that one was, you know, the atmosphere that day was just a few ingredients short, yeah, of producing just a monster tornado that would have gone across a dozens of communities and multiple hospitals and terminals B and C at O'Hare. I mean, yeah, it just could have been
rush hour on the tri-state.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. I mean, it just, we were so close, and NWS meteorologists were on top of that, watching it every step of the way. 24/7 monitoring is just so key to getting these warnings out and making sure that, you know, if you are out on the highway, you know, your phone going to go off when you got to do something.
Or if you're in a plane, you know, wherever it may be. And Dr. Webbles, can you speak to those $27 billion weather events, catastrophes that we've had in the past year, and whether you anticipate that number is going to increase?
Oh, I think it certainly is going to increase. So, you know, so changes in climate, first of all, are the long-term variations in weather, right? So it's the statistics and averages of weather. And what we're seeing is not only are global temperatures increasing, or temperatures in the United States increasing, but more importantly, we're seeing an intensifying of the energy in the atmosphere, leading to more concerns about major weather events. So those are the things that are causing these 27 disasters we've seen this last year, and I think the year before it was 24 or something like that. But it's been increasing dramatically over the last 40 years, and it's going to continue to increase. So, do we have to wait till we have one of these every week before we're going to start doing something about climate change? It seems kind of ridiculous. This is costing the American people trillions of dollars. And they just don't realize it because they pay it, you know, you pay for these disasters through your taxes. We need to account for the fact that this is one of the most important issues of, certainly of our time, but perhaps of all time, and that dealing with the fact that our climate is changing, which is changing because of human activities, that we can do something about this and that we can make a difference towards getting things more stable and to have a more sustainable life. for all of us.
Yeah, and Don talks about the increasing extreme events. One aspect of that that's plainly visible is the rainfall rate.
Yes.
Okay. So what we're seeing, like in New York City during Henri, and then I think it was Ida, rainfall rates exceeding 4 inches an hour over the whole city. It was the first time there was a flash flood emergency issued for the entire city. And people who were pre-positioned, prepared for the rain and all that, were absolutely stunned by what they were witnessing, you know, at 4.5 inches an hour. I mean, those are rainfall rates you normally observe in the tropics, not in the mid-latitude and above. You look at Asheville, North Carolina. They've had extreme floods before, and they've rebuilt after those floods, thinking that it would hold. So it's not just the amount of rain that they had. They had two separate rain events, you know, within 24 hours of each other. But it was the rainfall rates, especially in the second one, that the infrastructure just couldn't handle it. In Ellicott City in Maryland, they had two flood events in 2 years. It was essentially a flash flood event, then another one related to thunderstorms that put down 5 inches of rain in less than an hour. You know, the infrastructure just can't handle that. We're seeing more of those kind of events. And, you know, that in the recorded history, at least of this country, we hadn't seen before. So it's clear, and people who were predicting in the 1990s what would climate change look like, one of the things they said is the atmosphere could handle more water vapor. So there's a physical reason this is happening. A warmer atmosphere can handle more water vapor. If you got more water vapor in the atmosphere, there's a possibility you're going to get more rain. What is happening on top of that is that that's being squeezed into a shorter period of time. So yes. So when you have that, you not only have Asheville. Look at Nashville. A couple of years ago, they had one of these events from thunderstorms that, when they saw the damage from the along the river valley, it looked like an inland tsunami. In fact, the local people was like, this looks like what a tsunami does. Everything was in splinters, like what they saw west of Asheville in this case. So, you know, we have to recognize that that's happened. The droughts are more extreme. The fires are hotter. They're moving faster. Well, you know, you can't wait for the fire coming over the hill to evacuate. You got to start evacuating people two days before the event. Now, this is what the firefighters are seeing, because what happened in Paradise and other fires back in 2017 was that, using the old way, the firefighters had to start evacuating people and stop fighting the fire, right? So there's so many changes that you can point to over the last 10 to 15 years in terms of the nature of the meteorological event and the imperative to start getting your response before the event so you can get people out of harm's way and deal with the event. One of the quotes we got when if you talk to the emergency managers, they all recognize that, hey, you know, the Weather Service is getting us ahead of the event. My favorite quote as the Weather Service Director was from Eric Waage up in Hennepin County, Minnesota, who at a conference, without any prompting, said that the Weather Service action of connecting their forecast more effectively to the emergency management as a team approach has revolutionized the emergency management response from being reactive to an oncoming extreme event, to be proactively prepared and more properly responding to those events, that this was a revolutionary change in the way the emergency management community operated as a team at every government level. We've been able to build off of that, and I think it's been very successful in moving this country forward in terms of responding to these kind of events. And my fear is that we're going to not only undo the collaborative relationship within the weather enterprise, but undo this collaborative relationship within the decision making because we're not going to have the resources to continue and sustain this type of interaction. And this cuts across the entire economy and the entire societal nature within the United States that includes, you know, everybody. You know, I mean, we literally touch every county every day. So I am concerned. I'm concerned about today's cuts. I'm concerned about the impact on the future. I mentioned this earlier in one of your broadcasts, Lisa, that it's not just the people that got terminated now who had their dreams about working in this from childhood like I did, like Tom did, I'm sure Ed. Everybody has their childhood experience that got them interested in meteorology and carried them through into a career. It's what's going on now with university students, people in the military, that the veterans who want to continue their service in meteorology, the folks in the private sector. These are really dedicated people, and the people coming up also had their dreams of doing this. And quite frankly, I fear for how they're viewing what their prospects are and not being able to fill in behind the current generation of people that are doing this. So,
Louis, yeah. It's happening. Do you know when I first put up on social media, and I wasn't sure what the reaction would be, when the word of the cuts came down a couple of Thursdays ago, I put something up on Facebook. I thought, I wonder, you know, what the response will be. The comments came pouring in, and a lot of them were from parents who said, I've got a youngster who's studying meteorology. I mean, the station manager of this station has a young, Mary Boyle has a young son mm-hmm. who's approaching college age. He's going to be going off to study at Penn State or Ohio State meteorology. It's been a dream of his entire life. And every one of us, there's something unique about us weather types. Maybe it's because we swim in this atmosphere 24 hours a day and it's always around us. There's a love, a passion and all that is it's just amazing. The number of people you talk to who pursue careers in meteorology have often can trace it back to a childhood interest in weather. And these young people dream. A weather service job is literally a job that young people dream about, the way some people dream about becoming a fireman or a policeman or something like that. This is a goal that people set. I was out at Northern Illinois University. We're putting a television piece together on these cuts. And I visited Victor Gensini, Dr. Vencini, Gensini, out at NIU. He's a professor there and an incredible tornado researcher. He's doing some groundbreaking work in that area. But he had a synoptic meteorology class. These are the young people that will be the weather forecasters of the future. And he said, Skilling, come on in and say a couple of words to them. And I look out at this sea of young faces. I mean, it's like when you go to the doctor when you're older and they're younger than you are, and you think, my God, you know, it's like like children or our kids are helping us with whatever ails us. Well, here is this classroom of young people, and they're all wondering, what future do I have? Studying meteorology is tough. That's a tough degree. This is not basket weaving. I mean, you're doing some serious studies to obtain a degree in meteorology. And the people, you know, you accumulate wisdom as you proceed in any career. But that's true in weather. I mean, you get better as you go on, as you see the atmosphere going through more of its phases and all. You learn something from every development on the way. And these young people are starting that journey, and they have this passion burning inside them. And they're being told that the agency that they may seek to be employed by at some point is going to be decimated for unknown reasons, under false pretenses that the agency is bloated and that it's not functioning efficiently and all the rest. And there's not a lot they can do about it. Lisa, that's why I salute you. You offer us a platform to tell the public, because the public, time and again, when they rate agencies of the federal government that succeed at what they're doing, the Weather Service is held at a level of esteem and appreciation unlike most. It's like the Social Security Administration or something. People depend on weather data, and they respect and admire what the Weather Service does. There aren't people, as Ed said in our last show, you don't go in this profession to get rich. You do it because there's a passion. There's an interest in this field. And it's alive and well. And we want to foster that in our young people who look to this as a potential career. The developments and the advances that have been made in meteorology are stunning. More has happened in meteorology, and I'm sure, Louis, in our lifetime than probably had in all the time from back to Aristotle, 340 BC, when he wrote Meteorologica.
But you still need the human touch and the human element.
We do.
That's what's key.
Yes.
And that, as the non-scientist in this conversation, concerns me, because most of us just want to take care of our kids. We want to have a roof over our head. We experience food different. We work in different careers. We look at things differently. But we experience the weather the same.
Lisa, you've got a farm.
Right.
You understand. You have a husband who's a farmer. You work on the farm. You understand this is the interface between meteorological data and information and forecasts producing the food. We're the breadbasket of America here. Weather plays a role, and farmers.
And so does climate.
Exactly. By the way, Don is a farm boy. It's funny. Somebody was attacking him being a climate scientist, and Don said, "Look, I'm just a Southern Illinois farm boy who grew up with an interest in the weather and climate and all." And I thought, you know, that's a great way to do it. It kind of defangs your critics, and you realize that these aren't evil monsters that are out to somehow, disrupt your lives.
And, Don, this generation of farmers, they understand climate change because they try to navigate it. They try to mitigate it. And maybe their fathers didn't, and their grandfathers didn't have any understanding of it. But they see the results, and they believe and they rely on the very people in this discussion, because it's how they make their money, and they perceive themselves as the conservationists of that land.
Absolutely.
They protect that land.
Absolutely.
It's been in their family for many generations, and they feel they have a duty. And I think that's what I've learned from all of you today. This is a duty. This is a service. This is something you were called to. This isn't something you chose because you thought it was glamorous.
Yeah.
It's who you are.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah.
Louis made the comment. He said, "I don't know why I was interested. Nobody in my family it was interested in the weather." Same with me. My parents couldn't figure out what they'd done wrong.
Same here. My family were all farmers, and they could not understand why did I want to do science.
It's so funny. Psychic tell me once that I was a ship captain in a previous life. Now, I don't know if I buy that or not, but I'll tell you, it's as good an explanation as I've got about it, how I wound up there. That's interesting, Don.
And Don, now you know that of the many hats that farmers wear, scientist is one of the hats.
Oh, definitely. I get asked through our agricultural college quite often to give talks to farmers when they're having special meetings here on campus. And it used to be, you were right, that, I'd give a talk about climate change and there'd be a lot of, questioning whether this is real or not by the farmers, largely because of political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer the case. When I give a talk to farmers now, they say, "Oh yeah, we're seeing the changes in our own farm, and so we know that this is important, and we got to figure out how to address it and deal with it." And that's right. We we're happy to work with the farmers to help them, be more resilient, to be able to address the issues. I think the scientists not only want to understand the science, which of course we spend most of our time on, but we want to also help society be improved and to prosper. I adore farmers, and I want them to succeed.
Absolutely, and they have to focus on weather. They have to focus on finance, on markets, on seed, the ever-changing weather. And I think that they feel the impact of this maybe deeper than the average person living in the suburbs, unless, like you said, Ed, they're living on a river and they know that, you know, those flood warnings are of utmost importance.
Yeah, and you know, taking it down even further, you look at how people use weather information, you know, what to wear today, you know, what's it going to be like to get to work or school? How about, you know, yard work? We're coming up to yard work season. It's coming slow, but it's coming.
Yeah.
Yard work and gardening. Hey, what's it going to be like out there? How about different job activities, construction, social activities? How about going out traveling? You know, there's just a myriad of things that this weather information is used for. I mean, it's just nearly every segment of our communities and private businesses rely on National Weather Service forecasts and data, farmers to pilots to construction to mariners, land management agencies to emergency management, and you know, blind cutbacks, they're going to harm people and they're going to hurt business.
I like that you're wrapping up with that. How would you like to wrap up this conversation, Don? How would you like to conclude with your comments?
You know, I just going back what Louie and Ed and Tom have said before, that an organization like NOAA, and we could also talk about other agencies in much the same way, have an extreme value to the American people. And that needs to be better recognized, that the way cuts are going on. You know, none of us mind that you know, looking at where we can reduce waste. I mean, we're all Americans. We all want to, you know, make sure we're being efficient. But that's not what's going on here. And it is a significant fear that not only about NOAA, but about science in general, that we need to recognize that science is so important to all of us. Since World War II, how technology developed in this country was because of science. And science continues to be a major part of affecting our lives and our futures, and we need to recognize that.
What would you like, Louis, your last remarks?
Well, I was just sitting here thinking, you know, just what Don was just talking about is absolutely true. And I was also reflecting on the fact that these decisions, these draconian decisions, these destructive decisions, are uninformed. And a number of people who are entering government now in the current administration ran businesses. And I cannot believe they would run their business this way. You know, the people who work for you are your most valuable asset. And the civil servants in this country have a long history of doing what the law says to do, because every year you get a budget and basically specify what Congress wants you to do or not. I mean, everything that we are doing in the Weather Service today is authorized by law after careful consideration. It's appropriated every year with a budget that you have to live by. It's really well planned out. And I don't think people who are making these decisions today understand that. And by forcing this on the people who are the most valuable asset, who will actually make things happen once an administration decides which way they want to go, they're going to have to rely on the civil servants to get it done. It does boggle the mind. And so I just hope that you know, people see, especially with respect to what we're talking about now, and Don's right, it is across NOAA. It's actually across the agency, with very strong partnerships with NASA and other Department of Energy, and there's a lot of people working in this arena now. So that's one thing I really, you know, really want to get across, that this will affect the impact that this information has been having on public safety. All right. I know people still lose their lives in these extreme events, but you look at Katrina, thousands of lives were lost, right, versus what we can do now with oncoming hurricanes. It's just, as an example, it's just, this is something that should be embraced and moved forward, not pulled apart at the seams. So that's what's driving my concerns and my interest in speaking out.
And you're speaking out as 33 years at the National Weather Service. This is Ed Fenlon.
Yeah, it's challenging to see such dedicated professionals facing what they're having to face right now. It's these are, like Tom mentioned, these are lifelong dreams for people. It was certainly a lifelong dream for me to get into the National Weather Service and have a career there. And I was so fortunate. I feel so fortunate to be able to do so, and hence my reason for wanting to speak out. These are people that are truly dedicated to serving the partners of the National Weather Service, working with other people to keep all of us safe. And we've got such a tremendous infrastructure there now, and it's all at risk.
Tom Skilling.
Well, you know, part of the reason this country is as great as it is and has been is because of the sorts of scientific work that's been done in this country. I mean, we've broken all kinds of barriers, and we live in a competitive world. Do we wish to cede our leadership in areas of science to other people, to the Chinese, to the, you know, anybody else who would compete with us? We're not operating in a vacuum over here. I mean, you know, this is one microcosm. Now, what's going on in the weather arena, this is extraordinary to me. We ought to be celebrating what's been done in meteorology. I mean, the accuracy of weather forecasts today, you know, people kid about it. If I had a dime for every time somebody said to me, boy, I wish I had a job where I could be wrong every day and keep my employment going.
they do love to say that.
Love to. But, you know, it isn't true. And then they'll ask you in the next breath, now, what's the weekend look like? it's crazy. But, you know, I'm so proud to consider these gentlemen and so many others, my colleagues and all. I mean, I'm in awe of what has been accomplished. And when I sit down and look at this incredible array of data that I have available that I could only dream about even 20 or 30 years ago, and we really have a fighting chance figuring out what tomorrow's weather is going to do, even what the weather next week is going to do and beyond. This is very important. And we see evidence all over on the impact of weather, these unusual and extreme and increasingly extreme weather events that go on. You know, the problem with climate science is, and getting people to believe it, is it doesn't happen every day. You don't look out your back window and say, oh, there's an example of climate change every day. It looks like everything's flowing along smoothly until you get a major weather event. And these major events are happening more frequently. And it's one of the functions of the National Weather Service to try and give us advance warning, and they're doing it pretty darn well. What's it take, like 3 days to evacuate a coastline when a hurricane is coming in now?
Yeah, the evacuation process can start 5 to 6 days before actual landfall.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when you cast doubt on the science, people are hesitant to leave because right. they never believe it's going to be that bad, yeah. even though you know it will be.
Yeah. And like, look at Hurricane Ian that decimated Florida. Ask people down there about trying to get insurance. You know, if they can get flood insurance, the premiums are 4 to 5 times what they were. And in many cases, ask folks in L.A. who are trying to get insurance against wildfires. These companies are pulling out of this. There's a reason for that. That's because these extreme events are going to bankrupt them. And so, you know, in Don's arena, in the climate arena, adaption. Don always says, you know, we're going to have to adapt to this changing climate. There are certain things we can mitigate, but we're going to have to build our structures in different locations so we're not as prone to flooding and hurricane devastation and so forth. There's a whole sea change that's going to have to take place as we adapt to the changing environment that is to be ours in the years to come. But we better darn well have the solid data on which to base the changes that we're going to make in our planning and so forth. And before you terminate a dedicated workforce, you ought to offer them at least a plausible explanation as to why they're being dedicated, why they're being separated from their employment. It seems to me to punish a workforce that's done their job admirably is not the way to go. And that's what's going on here with these cuts. And I'll tell you, I'll fight to my dying breath for my colleagues in the Weather Service, who I think do an amazing job. And I think most of us feel that way.
Absolutely. As an everyday American, these are not faceless federal employees.
No.
These are dedicated scientists. And we never even got to the people who repair those Doppler radars.
Oh, gosh, yes.
You know, the people who are actually so well-trained that I don't know how long it would take to replace people that we lost.
You couldn't. There's a certain skill set that just develops through experience.
Just remember, 24/7 by 365, no days off.
No.
Weather and climate do not take a break. You have to have reliable systems managed by dedicated people to be able just to do that, to be on there. And the thing that, again, I know we could go on and on, and we probably have to wrap this up, but the thing is, you know, when Weather Service people in local offices and all that are preparing for an oncoming blizzard, you know, they bring their backpacks and their sleeping bags with them because they know they might not get home.
Right.
And they don't want their colleagues to come to work in that dangerous blizzard, so they stay there the whole time. So, anyway.
And you've seen that, Ed. You've seen that in action.
Yes, absolutely. And that's somebody that's dedicated. They're going to come in and make sure that they're there to get the information out that people need to make life and death decisions.
Okay, I don't think any of these scientists will ask you, but I'm a call to action person. So if you have listened to this podcast and you believe that the importance of the weather is worth every cent we put into it, that this is not a bloated government agency, do what you have to do as an American citizen, and that is call the White House, call your representatives, make sure your voice is heard. All you can do is amplify what you have heard today, maybe by sharing this podcast, but take action. Don't be paralyzed because this impacts all of us. Is there anything else you would like to add, Tom?
Thank you, Lisa. Thanks for the platform to discuss this critically important subject. How nice of you to do it. And thank you. I know I speak for all of us here for that.
Our thanks are to you. You're the scientists. You're the people who inform us and ultimately save lives. We wouldn't... I just think that many of us might not be here without the science that you have shared with the public over the years. And I hope there are many people like you coming up the ranks and that they will find employment in the very agencies we're trying to save.
Thank you, Lisa. And by the way, thanks for what you do on the farm because we all like to eat. So
Oh, I just drive the combine sometimes. I'm not the real farmer.
There's a skill set that is acquired over the years. Wow.
Thank you so much. Tom Skilling, beloved meteorologist and TV personality in Chicago. Dr. Louis Uccellini, your credentials would take the next 30 minutes to try and explain. But we appreciate you being here. Ed Fenelon, thank you so much. 33 years with the National Weather Service. And Dr. Webbles, I wish you could have been here in person because it's always lovely to see all the faces. But thank you for participating. And nice to have someone that grew up on a farm join us in this conversation. And,
well, I'll be happy to join you again in person. You just let me know when.
Awesome.
We will do it again. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Lisa.